This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. The legislature is looking at ways to protect kids from school shootings. One way is to arm teachers to cut down on response time.
The average length of time it takes for the shooter to begin and end is 3 to 5 minutes. The average is way past 5 minutes for police to arrive.
Today, Netflix releases a series on Flint Police.
Flint is the most understaffed police department in America of any comparable city.
The Michigan Farm Bureau is pushing for legislation to make it easier for farmers to withdraw groundwater and then keep how much a secret because terrorists.
This argument about terrorism is frankly, I think, a little silly.
And how do you describe Michigan's roads?
Yeah, travesty and mockery. A travesty, a shame, and a mockery.
But first, here's a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. 50 years ago, a report on the 1967 civil disturbances in Detroit and other cities was released. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk to the author of a new book on the Kerner Report. But first, this week alone, 4 people were shot and killed by one gunman in Detroit. There was an apparent murder-suicide in Southfield. A Grand Rapids man was killed after being shot 10 times. And today, 2 people were shot and killed at Central Michigan University. Government leaders in Washington and in Lansing are trying to come up with ways to prevent mass shootings. The main focus is on shootings at schools, such as the one last month at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. At the state capitol, Representative Jim Rundstedt is drafting a proposal that would allow teachers to be armed. Representative Rundstedt joins us now. Your proposal is not about teachers and conceal and carry or open carry, but access to a weapon. How would that work?
How it would work is that if a school chose to have what are called school marshals in other states, they would have to vote to do it. So that's the first misconception that I've heard from different parts of concern is whether it would be mandatory. And I want to assure everyone it would not be mandatory. The school board would have to vote this policy in. Then as far as the school personnel, again, I was hearing, well, you're going to require the teachers to have weapons? No, absolutely not. There's teachers that you certainly would not want to have a weapon. So they would have to volunteer for this position of school marshal. And that wouldn't be good enough because they would have to go through a complete background check of moral turpitude, of psychological, mental state of mind, physical capacity. Everything that law enforcement would go through, they would have to go through in order to secure this position. Then beyond that, they would have to go through rigorous training, just like the police. 80 hours every 2 years, active shooter, de-escalation. What do you do in all of these scenarios? What is the proper protocols, procedures, so they know precisely what to do in the event that one of these emergencies do occur? Now, what would they be able to do in these scenarios if they're teaching their class, an active shooter comes in the school? There's a lot of discussion right now in Lansing about loaning schools a lot more money for security systems. But the reality is, in every school in Michigan, with a hammer or whatever, they can break in any window. They're in the school in seconds. Doesn't matter that you got the big security door and the buzz in and the cameras, and they could bust in seconds being in the school. So at that point, what happens? Well, every shooting situation, the average length of time it takes for the shooter to begin and end is 3 to 5 minutes. And every case, the average is way past 5 minutes for police to arrive. So what happens in that moment? At that time, that well-trained volunteer in the classroom would have access inside a locked steel cabinet that only they have the key to, is a safe that their thumbprint instantaneously opens and they have access to a loaded weapon. Them turning the key to the steel file cabinet, them putting the thumbprint on, seconds. When seconds matter, the police are there in minutes is an old mantra. And that is precisely what we're talking about, trying to save the lives of the children when seconds do matter. At that point, that trained individual, 80 hours of training, vetting, knowing precisely what to do, his job is to save the children within the classroom, not to run around the school and try to figure out what's happening with the weapon, but purely to save the children within the school. I read a
let me get a question in here. Emily Lawler at MLive is reporting the Michigan Sheriff's Association is not in favor of having secured weapons available to teachers at school. They think the better choice is a trained and armed officer at the school. What's your reaction to the Sheriff's Association's concerns?
Number one, I saw that being the president. I didn't see an actual position taken by the Sheriff's Association.
You're correct. That's correct.
But I did also see an individual who's the chief of police in the city of Detroit saying we absolutely have to do this. On the Frank Beckman show here in southeastern Michigan, the largest radio show, had on the president of the police officers union in Broward County where the shooting occurred. He said he absolutely supports it. There's a huge survey, over 15,000 officers by Police One, one of the largest police officer websites. Over 81% of police officers support this. I just got a Rasmussen report of parents of school-aged children. The majority support this. Why do they all support this? For one reason, response time. I have a 16-year-old daughter. Every time I see one of these alerts come in on my phone, it's usually something minor, but I have trepidation. Every time I see that alert, is there an active shooter? Response time, saving children's lives. This is why there's all this support. When people realize, like you're doing here, very good service to the community, to educate them about what we're actually talking about and not what they've heard of all these precautions, this vetting, this training that are involved, there is support for this.
Let me ask you about some other legislation that's out there. Representative Gary Glenn is also proposing legislation that would allow school employees with conceal and carry permits to be armed at school if they receive additional training, and another bill that would require, mandate school districts allow those employees with concealed carry permits to come to school armed. What do you think of Representative Glenn's proposals?
Well, my dad was a principal. My mom was a school teacher. My sister was a school teacher. I was trained as a school teacher, almost all on the middle school and elementary school level. The interactions that you have with a child, you're sometimes rolling around on the floor being a monkey or you're doing somersaults, and I just don't see that being viable in my opinion.
You're concerned about a discharge of a weapon, accidental discharge?
Or you have, I watched the video of a teacher, probably 6 feet tall, a eighth grader who was almost 6 feet tall. The eighth grader was shoving the teacher, and pretty soon it turned into a grappling. They're grappling, smashing over computers, and to have that teacher have a loaded weapon on them in a scenario. I just personally, I've seen these things occur in the classroom. I just don't think I would want to have that scenario play out where if you're carrying a weapon all day long, the kids are going to know. They're going to know who does. The proposal I have is a sky marshal system in the schools. So nobody is going to know. No one's going to disclose who is in a cabinet that's locked safe. Not one person is going to be talking about that. That's going to be part of all the protocols of this.
Let me ask you about some other legislation that's being proposed. I talked to Representative Robert Wittenberg last week about his bills that would allow family members or law enforcement to ask a judge to temporarily take away guns from a person who poses a threat to others or themselves, a so-called red flag measure. Is that legislation getting a hearing?
I'm having a meeting with Representative Wittenberg and law enforcement next week. All law enforcement has problems with this concept as written. They are very outspoken that someone makes an allegation about someone else. It could be a scenario where the individual being accused doesn't even get any court time to give it an alternate side. The police are sent out to collect this gun, and they're being told this person may have mental issues and has a weapon. They have whole protocols for this that may require a SWAT team, that may require a team that deals with suicide prevention, and none of this is going to be in the calculus. It's going to be a police officer sent out on someone say-so, could be an ex-lover. There's just so many issues that they have with it where it's currently written.
I want to ask you about other ideas being considered in Lansing. The Democrats are proposing a universal background check. What are your thoughts on that?
I believe I just heard about that yesterday. I haven't seen anything about it until I even have a concept about you know, what are they talking about? Where are the areas that need additional work? I'm just not familiar with that. If I had known even a few days ago and did some research, I'd have an educated answer for you.
Fair enough. So are there any other ideas being considered in Lansing to prevent school shootings?
Yes, there's a lot of discussion on mental health. We discussed a number of bills pertaining to mental health that we believe will have some impact on identifying and removing weapons from mental health individuals. There's a lot of work being done on that, and I think that there's, from what I'm hearing, we're going to be seeing some bills coming out of that mental health committee that will have overlay with preventing them from getting weapons. There's also some suggestion I'm hearing out of the Senate that there may be loans done for security systems that would come out of the rainy day fund. So there's a lot of discussion going on about what are some solutions.
What's the sense of urgency among your fellow legislators about this issue?
I think everybody has concern when you have a scenario like what happened in Florida. What can we do to make things better? I mean, I hear that everywhere. That's why I've been fast-tracking the concept I'm working on. I have a 16-year-old daughter. People seem to lose track that legislators have children. You know, she's my world. She's my wife's world. There's nothing we wouldn't do. We would run in front of a speeding train. We'd step in front of a bullet. There is nothing we won't do to protect her. So we're legislators, but we're also parents. This is a high priority for us.
Representative Jim Renstad is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee and currently drafting legislation that would allow trained school personnel access to weapons during an active shooter situation at a school. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester.
Up next, we'll talk to the director of a new Netflix series about Flint police. Plus, how do you describe Michigan's roads?
Yeah, travesty and mockery. A travesty, a shame, and a mockery.
That's 20 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, Netflix is releasing a new original docu-series about Flint. During 2016, the producers of Flint Town followed the police department. Here's a bit from the intro which sets the scene for Flint Town.
Down on your knees.
Poverty and lack of opportunity, it breeds crime.
This is a story about an American city in critical condition.
We've been in the, top three most violent cities of the country for how many decades?
We're inundated by violence. We're inundated by workload.
We're just going from call to call to call to call.
To another call to another call.
We feel inadequate because we don't have the manpower we used to have.
There's just not enough of us.
Community, they had a complete lack of trust in us. Complete lack of trust.
Are they pissed? F*** yeah. Pissed.
We got a right to voice our f***ing opinion as long as we f***ing want to.
So if you got the community and the police department at odds, the police department ain't shit.
I have a son, and it makes me emotional because, you know, it makes me afraid for him to grow up.
Then you throw in there a water crisis.
I've definitely been bathing in the Flint water. Don't know how that's going to affect my health.
How is there not civil unrest?
I don't think anyone's coming to help us.
Joining me now is one of the directors of Flint Town, Zach Canapari. Of course, Flint caught the attention of the nation and the world because its water was contaminated by lead because of some bad decisions by government officials. But you went deeper than that. Why did you think there was more to the story?
Well, I mean, I've been working in Flint since 2012, so I was not only engaged with the community, but I was very aware of what the community was going through before the water crisis. You know, Flint has been for decades now the poster child for the American dream turned into the American nightmare. And so I was interested in what was happening there, you know, way before the water crisis even started. And it felt like a really important place in the American narrative. You know, it's kind of ground zero for American mismanagement and things like that. And the same set of circumstances that led to the water crisis also led to this depleted police department. And so we just saw, you know, a unique way to tell a story about this community and make it engaging for audiences across different spectrums.
We should mention you were making another documentary in Flint. Tell us quickly what that was about.
I made another documentary in Flint in 2012, 2015 about Clarissa Shields called T-Rex. She's the female boxer that won the gold medal in the Olympics in 2012.
Yeah, we all know
and
her.
And then 2006. Yeah, I know. I'm like, I got to think about my audience here a little bit. But, like, you know, she's a real star, and we were hanging out with her very early in her career. And I think through our experience working with her, we just saw a side of Flint that, you know, I think we found really magnetic and interesting. And we just ended up sticking around. I've done a lot of other projects there, and it kind of all led to this police department project, Flint Town.
And why did you feel the perspective of the police was the best approach to tell Flint's story?
Well, a couple of things. You know, I mean, I think policing in America obviously is an extremely important issue. And, you know, around the time of 2015, 2016, it was a major part of the news cycle. It's been sort of overshadowed lately. And, you know, I think we felt like it was important for us to sort of have a perspective on that as filmmakers, as storytellers, as journalists. So, you know, that was one part of it. I think the other part of it was that we also knew that Flint was a unique police department. You know, it's a homegrown police department, local officers mostly from the community, families in the community. And then also on top of that, they are completely overwhelmed. They don't have the resources or the guys really to do, you know, to deal with a city of Flint's size and Flint's crime rate.
I want to get to more of that, but I want to ask you how difficult it was to persuade the department and then the individual officers to allow you in.
Yeah, the short answer is that it wasn't that difficult. T-Rex, the film we made about Clarissa Shields, really kind of helped pave the path for us to, you know, make connections in Flint. I mean, I think a positive story that comes out of Flint really sort of opened up new doors for us. And I think once we approached the police department, we were fairly warmly received. You know, it took some time to sort of figure out what we were doing there. We didn't totally understand the lay of the land. A lot of it is like, how does the police department work? And once we got into cars with the officers, you know, a few officers for sure were hesitant and took some time to warm up and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But a few officers, you know, my first night out, I rode with Officer Frost, who's featured in the show. And, you know, at that time, things were pretty raw for these guys. And they were, you know, in the middle of so many different issues. And Frost was willing to sort of be opinionated and willing to be open about what was going on. And so I think right from there, I knew we had something unique. Hearing from these officers, hearing from police officers in this way is what makes our show really different. And I think that, you know, right from the beginning, I kind of glimpsed this. It took us some time to get other officers involved, but at the same time, we knew that we were getting a unique POV of this situation in Flint.
This first episode of Flint Town is about change, new mayor, a new police chief. But the underlying problems for the officers is something you touched on. A decade ago, there were 300 officers in Flint, and in 2016, they were down to 98.
Mm-hmm.
How were you able to convey all the implications of being so understaffed?
Well, you know, right now, today, Flint is the most understaffed police department in America of any comparable city. You know, with its violent crime rates and its issues, you know, it is really overwhelmed. And they try so many different things to make it work with what they have, but it's a nearly impossible game to win with what they have without, you know, new influx of officers, all that stuff. I think what struck us was that, you know, the same emergency manager system that came in and created the water crisis in Flint also gutted the police department. You know, this is all about saving money. And public safety is one of the first things to go. And so, you know, the officers there were part of this kind of constant budget cuts and constant layoffs. And many of these officers who have had many years on this department have been laid off multiple times. And so you know, they were a department on edge. They were a department on the fringe. And so we, you know, we kind of saw something really unique that they kept coming back to. You know, they kept coming back to Flint. And a lot about it, about their character. They're choosing, in some sense, to stay and try to figure it out. So there's all these different factors that kind of led to the story, you know, and what these guys were going through and how we were telling the story.
This is an 8-part series which spans a year. Now, you didn't have a crystal ball. You didn't know exactly where the story was going. So how do you determine what is part of the series and what is not?
Yeah, a lot of trial and error, I think, is the short answer. Documentary filmmaking, visual storytelling, all these, you know, journalism in general. I mean, I think in some way you're kind of looking for a certain number of parameters in which to tell a story, and then you go in there and hope that something happens, or, you know, you're basically trying to document what's happening. So I think a lot of this stuff we figured out as we went, and we had some very clear ideas. We knew the millage, which is the big citywide vote about police department funding that happened on election day, would be a big storyline. We knew that Halloween is a big weekend in Flint. We knew that 4th of July is a big weekend in Flint. So we had some ideas about when to be there, but I think that, like, things progress and things change in a city like Flint all the time. It's constantly changing because people are constantly trying new things and trying to figure things out. So, you know, it wasn't really until we got into the edit that we started to really figure out how we wanted to put the story together. We had ideas, but, you know, until you get in there and look at what you've got, it was a little bit more of a guess than an accurate sort of representation. And you know, some stuff really surprised us as being stronger than we thought it would be. I mean, some stuff actually didn't work out quite the way we thought it would be.
So what do you and your co-directors hope the audience gets from the Flint Town series?
You know, I worked with Jessica Dimmock and Dre Cooper on this project. They're the co-directors. And I think the three of us have, you know, slightly different ideas about what the audience will take from it. But I think, you know, for us, all of us sort of saw that the police community relationship is only going to work out if the other systems around it are working. Poverty, education, infrastructure, all these things need to be in place for a police and a community to get along. Otherwise, they're doing something that may be a game that nobody can actually win.
Zach Canapari is one of the directors of the Netflix original docuseries Flint Town, which is being released today. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you, Lester. Appreciate it.
The Michigan Farm Bureau is backing new rules for withdrawing water, and House Republicans are obliging them so far. Here to talk about that are Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us by Skype. The complaint is the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality takes way too long to review large quantity with water withdrawal permits for things such as irrigation. That actually is one of the big water users. They use more unrecoverable water than any other source in the state. They say also the DEQ's science is out of date. Vicki, the chief sponsor is Representative Aaron Miller from Sturgis. I was just driving through his district this week. There are a lot of irrigation rigs and farm fields in that area. Is the DEQ hindering farmers, and is that science outdated?
No and no. The science is not outdated, and we're not hindering farmers. This is for very, very large water withdrawals. We're talking about over 100,000 gallons a day in withdrawal, and it's sufficient for most of the farming needs of our state already, and there is no reason to stop using the water resources tool. And that was part of the Great Lakes Compact. This doesn't just affect the state of Michigan. This bill will have an impact on the Great Lakes Compact and all Great Lakes states in the Great Lakes water basin. So it is prudent to take time and due diligence to approve heavy use of our water.
Ken, is the science outdated that the DEQ uses to assess water withdrawals?
Well, I don't know if it's outdated. The scientific modeling that was used to create the current statute is basically kind of 10 years old, and it probably does make sense to revisit that. I just don't think the legislature is the best body to revisit the, you know, science of water withdrawal and hydrology. There is a Water Use Advisory Council that has scientists on it, and in my view, that that's the group that ought to be looking at it, not the legislature.
Well, how do you balance the needs of the farmers and the natural resources we all share? I mean, environmentalists and anglers are not happy about this at all.
Well, going back to Ken's current statement, if the science is outdated, this bill does nothing to request that the science be updated at all, and in fact shifts the burden of scientific research onto paid hired consultants by the water withdrawer. So I think it's a real problem.
One of the key elements of the legislation is that the government would hide data on water use by agriculture. It would be exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. The Farm Bureau apparently believes it's needed to prevent terrorist activities. Ken, should the government hide how much water farmers use?
No, it should not. This exemption from FOIA is actually particularly problematic in this case because right now, the Department of Environmental Quality really doesn't have sufficient staff to respond timely to these requests, and exempting the data and the requests from FOIA simply means that others wouldn't be able to respond either. So that is not really acceptable. This argument about terrorism is frankly, I think, a little silly.
Vicki, thoughts on water withdrawal secrecy?
Well, in an age when we're all clamoring for more transparency and a legislature is saying that it's trying to be more transparent, this really is a slap in the face of the citizens of the state of Michigan and really hurts neighbors. If a neighbor can't find out what's going on a neighboring property where they've requested to withdraw a lot of water, that's problematic for the neighbor that's trying to use the water right now.
Right. The water table doesn't recognize your property line.
It's called a fugitive asset. It moves.
As you know, there's been an uproar about Nestle's request to pump out more water for bottling. Presumably, this would benefit that effort as well. But agriculture uses vastly more water than bottlers such as Nestle. And besides the farmers, two other big companies would benefit. That would be Monsanto and Pioneer Seed Company, as farmers contract with the companies to grow more seed corn in the southwest part of the state. But here's the big question to me. We're a water-rich state. What's the harm in profiting from that more than we already are? Vicki?
This is not our water alone. This is water for our generations to come, and we need to safeguard our natural resources and use them responsibly. I don't know how many of the listeners know that Cape Town, South Africa, a port city, is on the verge of having no potable water at all. And droughts come and go, and sometimes they linger. And we don't know what the future brings, but we do know that right now we are home to 20% of the world's surface freshwater. I want to quote Representative Miller, who's been quoted in MLive newspaper. He responded to that exact question about Nestle, that this is, quote, "This is for any high-capacity water withdrawer, whether a company that produces the products or a water bottling plant and or growers. It covers everybody," end quote. In other words, Nestle would not have to seek approval in order to do its drastically increased withdrawals that are currently stalled by the DEQ.
Ken, we've got a lot of water. Why not use it?
Well, we also have a lot of water withdrawal in Michigan, and I'm not sure everybody appreciates that, whether it's municipal water supplies, industry, utilities, golf courses, you know, agriculture. There's just a lot of water withdrawal in Michigan, and withdrawing that isn't per se bad. It's a matter of, does it damage the aquifers and the water resources we have? That's why we have the DEQ involved in this. So there's nothing per se wrong with water withdrawals as long as it doesn't harm our water resources.
A final question for you both. Do you think that this would be different if we actually charge for a natural resource like this as we do for others?
Oh, that's a good question. The price of water is going up because of its growing scarcity. I don't know. I just think that we need to have a longer-term picture. Right now, we seem to look only for the current day and short-term solutions to issues that really have a tremendous impact on future generations of the state of Michigan. And we need to start looking long-term and preserve the natural resources we have and use them responsibly so that those resources can replenish and stay viable for generations to come.
Ken, are the fees set right for this kind of large water withdrawal?
You know, Lester, I think there's a problem there because you have to decide who do you charge. I mean, municipal water withdrawals, do you charge them? Do you charge agriculture? I mean, everybody would probably say, well, let's charge Nestle or commercial water withdrawals. But other entities are withdrawing and using our water, too. My preference is we focus on the environmental protection side, protecting exactly. these water resources over time.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator, and Vicki Barnett is a former Democrat in the legislature. Thanks for your insight, and have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Lester.
Still to come, we are paying more for Michigan roads, so why are there still so many potholes?
It's just been something that legislators are deathly afraid of casting votes on.
And then we'll talk to the author of a new book on race relations, 50 years after the Kerner Report. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Tire shops around the state are busy these days. Why? Blowouts because of potholes. And why are there so many potholes when we've been paying more in fees and fuel taxes? Well, we've got Zach Gorchell here to explain some of that. He recently wrote a blog for Gongwer titled Imploding Roads, Natural Consequence of 2015 Plan. Hi, Zach.
Hey, Lester.
Seems like we're hearing a lot about pothole stories. You've got one from East Lansing. What's your story?
Well, there's a road called Saginaw Highway, which cuts sort of right through the middle of town, and it has just been deteriorating for years. Horrible potholes, huge ruts. It's just disintegrating. And every year I keep thinking it's going to be resurfaced or reconstructed. Doesn't happen. And boy, when we had this latest freeze-thaw cycle, it's just blown apart. Like so many other roads.
Yeah, you called it a word I've not read or heard before, Travis-sham-mockery.
Yeah, Travis-sham-mockery, a travesty, a shame, and a mockery.
I know the 2015 road deal is a little complicated, but can you give us the basics?
So that deal raised the gasoline tax by 7.3 cents per gallon and then began indexing that to inflation. It also raised vehicle registration fees quite substantially, something your listeners, I'm sure, noticed last year. And then it also called for the state's general fund to kick in eventually by the 2021 fiscal year, $600 million. So when you add all that together, it is supposed to be $1.2 billion in new road spending compared to what was happening, let's say, around the year 2011.
Well, let's start with that amount. What did the governor want? What did he say we had to have, otherwise we'd see more deteriorating roads?
Well, people who recognize the need and work on roads for a living said the real need at the time this plan was passed was more than $2 billion. That $1.2 billion figure really dated toward the end of the Granholm administration, and by the time this plan passed in 2015, it was a really outdated figure. The governor, I think, wanted more. At one point, he may have asked for more. My memory is escaping me. But I think he basically recognized that getting just that $1.2 billion was going to be a Herculean task from the legislature, and he decided that's what to ask for.
Now, that one point you made about $600 million out of general fund money in the future, how likely is it that future legislatures will do that?
Well, look, come next year, there's going to be a new governor, two-thirds of the Senate will turn over, and more than a third of the House is going to turn over. And by 2021, the House will have almost totally turned over. So they're not bound to adhere to this. Yes, they would have to change the law that earmarks a portion of revenues that had been going to the general fund to the Michigan Transportation Fund. So they would have to change the law. But look, if and when there's a recession and revenues plummet, I just find it very hard to believe legislators and a new governor are going to sign away hundreds of millions of dollars to roads when they've got all kinds of other critical programs that they have said are priorities.
I guess it depends on what the roads look like in 2021.
And that is true.
Somebody pointed out Michigan drivers are spending more on car repairs because of potholes than they would spend in increased taxes to pay for well-maintained roads in the state. What's it going to take before we are willing to pay sufficiently to maintain the roads?
If I knew the answer to that, I'd probably be doing something else for a living.
You'd be head of the transportation department.
Yeah, I mean, everybody wants something for nothing, right? If you can get something for free, you do it. And, you know, I think the legislature figured, well, we'll have people pay for $600 million in new revenues through taxes and fees, but that other $600 million, most people aren't ever going to notice because we're taking it out of the general fund. Until motorists are just screaming at their legislators en masse, and who knows, maybe it's just going to simply take some legislators with a different worldview. I just don't see it happening. I mean, that was the first gasoline tax increase in almost 20 years when it passed. It's just been something that legislators are deathly afraid of casting votes on because they just fear there's going to be a backlash, especially on the Republican side, where it can be a very potent issue in primaries.
Zach Gorchow is Gongwer News Service Editor. Hey, good talking to you.
Thank you, Lester.
By the way, next week we'll talk to the head of the Michigan Department of Transportation, Kirk Steidel. So what kind of questions do you have about our roads for him? Leave us a voicemail at 734-764-7840. Again, that number is 734-764-7840. Fifty years ago, February 29th, 1968, a presidential commission released a report on why there had been so many uprisings, civil disturbances, riots by black citizens in cities across the country. The Koerner Report blamed the civil disturbances on white racism. Its most quoted line is, "Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black and one white, separate and unequal." A new book is out detailing the history of the Koerner Commission and its report. The title is Separate and Unequal, The Koerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism. The author is Stephen Gillen, and he joins us now. Before we get to the Koerner Commission, remind us what happened in 1967, which led to President Lyndon Johnson appointing that presidential commission.
Well, you have to realize from 1964 through 1967, there were riots in American cities every summer. And the most intense took place in the summer of 1967 in Newark, New Jersey, and in Detroit, but also in dozens of other cities. So there's a sense that society is unraveling. So in the wake of the massive riots, uprisings in Detroit and Michigan, Lyndon Johnson decides that he needs to do something. He needs to assert presidential authority. So he creates the Koerner Commission to make recommendations to him about, there's really three questions he poses. What happened? Why did it happen? And what can we do to prevent it from happening again?
Right. You've got a whole chapter on what do they want. Johnson was astonished. He couldn't understand why these uprisings were happening when he'd recently pushed civil rights legislation through Congress. How much did Johnson really understand about the position of African Americans in America?
There's sort of a split personality when it comes to Johnson. He certainly had tremendous empathy for African Americans. I mean, this is a guy who pushed through the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Here's a guy who spoke eloquently at Howard University about the problems facing African Americans. On the other hand, Johnson personalized problems, and he felt that African Americans should be grateful to him for all that he was doing. He took it personally that they were rioting. So the way Johnson rationalized it to himself wasn't that these were uprisings, a rational response to the horrible conditions in the cities, but this was somehow a conspiracy, that there were a handful of people like Stokely Carmichael who were going around and instigating these riots, who were taking people who were generally happy and satisfied and forcing them out into the streets.
Before things settled down in Detroit, the president announced his commission. It's handpicked by Johnson, including the supporting staff. He appointed Illinois Governor Otto Koerner as the chair of the commission, but you argue he wasn't really the leader. Liberal Republican Mayor of New York John Lindsay took a great deal of control over the direction of the commission. In what ways?
Beginning on the first day, John Lindsay said the only way we can prevent riots is to deal with the underlying causes of the riots, which is poverty, despair, a sense of people lack power and control over their own lives, that institutions are not responsive to their needs. He continued fighting until the very end. So much of that report is really the product of John Lindsay and also Fred Harris, Senator Fred Harris from Oklahoma. He and Lindsay were the two driving forces in pushing the commission to the left. Johnson came to resent Lindsay a great deal. He told the commission that he wanted them to follow the evidence wherever it took them. In fact, all he wanted them to do was to endorse his Great Society programs. And Lindsay was clearly pushing the commission to take bold positions that went far beyond what Johnson envisioned in his Great Society.
We don't have time to go over all of the grievances and the Kerner Report's recommendations in detail. What I want to just outline real quickly, they included things such as police practices, unemployment and underemployment, inadequate housing, inadequate education, poor recreation facilities and programs, ineffectiveness of the political structure and grievance mechanisms, disrespectful white attitudes, discriminatory administration of justice, inadequacy of federal programs, inadequacy of municipal services, and discriminatory consumer and credit practices as well as welfare programs. Now, a commissioner attended a law enforcement convention and was shocked by what he saw as the militarization of police forces. What did he see and what happened because of that?
He went to a gathering of local law enforcement officials in Washington, and he was shocked that there were all these advertisements for military-style equipment, tanks, to suppress uprisings. And his whole perspective is that you don't need tanks, you don't need military assault rifles. What you need is sort of more community engagement. You need to try to deal with the underlying issues that before they fester and turn into uprisings. And a lot of his recommendations were discarded. Conservative members of the commission simply opposed any suggestion that the police were somehow responsible for the uprisings.
We mentioned that it was 50 years ago this week, the report was turned in to President Johnson. How did Johnson feel about the findings of that report?
Well, he refused to even accept the report. He was furious. And he was furious because he thought it was impractical that here he was, and you have to understand his position. This is 1968. Congress is cutting many of the programs that already were part of the Great Society, and it was simply impossible for him to embrace a report that called for tens, if not hundreds, of millions of dollars in additional spending when he couldn't even get original programs funded. It put him in a very difficult position. It took him weeks before he would even mention the Kerner Commission.
At this point, Johnson has decided he's not running for re-election. Republican Richard Nixon, who was running for president, saw the Kerner Report as useful to his campaign. In what way?
You know, 1968 is such a critical year because what happens is the tectonic plates of American politics shift. So the whole old New Deal, Great Society coalition is being ripped apart because of social issues, especially the Vietnam War anti-war protests and urban uprisings. So it's allowing someone like Richard Nixon to appeal to many traditional Democrats by talking about law and order, essentially claim that Democrats are soft on crime and that we needed to have a new regime that would be tough on crime. And the Kerner Commission, with its criticism of the police and its call for new social programs, in Nixon's mind, this was rewarding the protesters and punishing the people who were trying to control some of the uprising. So the Kerner Commission comes out right in the beginning of this presidential campaign, and Richard Nixon, who had always been a racial moderate, now turns into a conservative populist. So I think in that sense, it contributes to this massive shift and the creation of this new conservative populism, which still dominates our politics today.
Your subtitle indicates the Kerner Commission factored into the unraveling of American liberalism. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the point I'm making is that if you look, we often look at the Kerner Commission, and justifiably so, as this bold statement about the way government and liberals should deal with urban problems. But if you look at the inner workings of the commission, you see all of the fractures that are existing in general society, existing within the commission itself. So you have these young field team representatives who are going into these urban areas, and they become deeply radicalized by their experience. And they believe that liberalism is too timid to deal with the profound problems that that they face in the city, that liberalism with its emphasis on slow, gradual change simply would not be able to address the massive inequality. And the only thing, the only way of doing that would be through some form of redistribution, which was simply not something that was a part of liberalism. And then you have people like Lindsay and Harris who are sort of within the liberal tradition, but sort of the far edge of the liberal tradition. And then you have someone like Tex Thornton, who gets voted down on just about every issue. He was a conservative businessman, a Johnson supporter, but on the right wing of the liberal coalition. And he objects to everything. And his point he's making it every time they're talking about issues and talking about creating programs to help the poor, he says that this is really a law enforcement issue. This is about punishing people who break the law. This is about the erosion of authority in society. So Tex Thornton, even though he gets voted down on just about everything, he more than anyone else sort of predicts the way that American politics was going to move. So if you look at the Kerner Commission, it's a microcosm of the fractures and divisions that are emerging in American society in the 1960s.
A multimedia group called the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, of which I'm one of the reporters, looked at some of the findings of the Kerner Report and looked at Detroit 50 years after the uprising in that city. And we found not much has changed, and in some instances, things have gotten worse since 1967 in Detroit. How true is that of other cities which experienced riots in the 1960s?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think on the one hand, you know, it's impossible to deny the progress that's been made. There's been a softening of racial attitudes. African Americans are better represented, still underrepresented, but better represented in business and in the media. There's been the emergence of an African American middle class that did not exist in 1967, at least it was not nearly the size it is now. We've had an African American president. So all that is clearly a sign of progress. But I believe that, you know, what the Kerner Commission said is we are becoming two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. And I think for those who have been left behind in these decaying urban centers, that they are more cut off from mainstream American society, that they are more separate, that the problems they face are more profound. And the problem we have is that one of the things the Kerner Commission said is what we need most of all is the political will to deal with these problems. And that political will has evaporated over the past 50 years, and it's non-existent today. While there's been tremendous improvement, I believe that in places like Detroit and in Newark, these urban areas, in many of these major cities, those people who are stuck there are more segregated from American society, have fewer opportunities and less hope than they did 50 years ago.
As you pointed out, the Kerner Report was basically shelved by the White House. And as you say, the nation chose a law and order president in Richard Nixon. But what is the lasting legacy of the Kerner Report 50 years after its release?
First of all, it's a marker that we can turn to see how much progress or lack of progress has been made. And we can get a sense of what has happened over the past 50 years so we know what we need to do when we eventually develop the political will to do it. But it's also, I think it is a powerful and important document that anyone who talks about race relations, anyone who talks about urban unrest, anyone who talks about discrimination, you have to go back and look at the Kerner Commission. Most of the attention is on those lines in the preface about white racism and becoming two societies. But the document itself is filled with data, overwhelming, convincing information that proves beyond any doubt that African Americans are treated poorly and that they live in horrible conditions. So that sort of deeply researched and convincing information becomes a reference point for anyone who talks about race and riots in America. And I think that when we finally come to our senses and develop the political will and come to recognize that racism is still a profound force in American society, that, you know, maybe we'll turn back to the Kerner Commission and realize what we have failed to do and find the will to do it.
Stephen M. Gillen is the author of Separate and Unequal, The Kerner Commission and the Unraveling of American Liberalism. Thanks for writing this.
Thank you. I really appreciate your interest in the Kerner Commission and the issues that it raises.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, who recently installed an update on all of the news computers, all of the news staff computers, all of them, except mine. Was it something I said about him on the air? Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hansel, Joey Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.